Welcome to What is Going Om for New Thought from the Edge of Om. Each week on Om Time's flagship radio show, veteran broadcaster, author, and media consultant Sandy Sedgbeer conducts thought-provoking interviews with inspirational authors, artists, musicians, scientists, speakers, and filmmakers who are working at the point where spirituality and science meet consciousness at the very edge of Om. Here is your host, Sandy Sedgbeer.
Hello. Have you ever wondered what caused Albert Einstein to recognize the general theory of relativity while laying in his bathtub? Or what inspired Steve Jobs to reimagine the personal computer and the phone, and then to dream up a tablet that didn't exist until everyone realized they had to have one? If you've ever puzzled over why some people have ideas that change the world, while others live lives of quiet imitation, or what you need to have or do to live an original, creative and brilliant life, stay tuned. For after studying the subject and speaking to 420 extraordinarily intelligent people for his latest book, today's guest knows the secrets. Arjuna Arda is a best-selling writer, public speaker and executive coach who's trained more than 2,000 coaches over the last 25 years. He's spoken at conferences all over the world, including at Google and the United Nations, and is the author of 9 books, including the 2005 national bestseller, The Translucent Revolution. Arjuna Arda joins me now to share some of the secrets revealed in his latest book, Radical Brilliance: The Anatomy of How and Why People Have Original Life-Changing Ideas. Arjuna Arda, welcome.
Hey, Sandy, thank you for having me back. It's a pleasure to hear your voice again.
You too, Arjuna. Now, in the first chapter of your book, Radical Brilliance, which you titled My Life as a Misfit, you briefly recount the different phases that your life has been through. Your privileged intellectual childhood, you attended King's School in Canterbury, which is one of the oldest schools in England. You went to Cambridge University. But all of that left you feeling somewhat restless and empty. And then you met a Hare Krishna monk in London, which started you on the road to seeking freedom through spirituality. Just tell us briefly, what happened to get you to the point where you began to gain some answers about what actually creates a life of deep fulfillment?
Well, Sandy, that's a huge question. I think it's a little bit like, I don't know, you could imagine just like going to the movies or watching TV or a video game or something, that you can get really caught up in a video game. You could get really caught up, especially if it's kind of one of those Oculus things, you know, with a headset and everything. And then, but somewhere in the back of your mind, you realize, wait a minute, this is not all there is. This is actually just like a game. This is a simulation, and there's something beyond this. And I think that's really what a lot of people understand in different ways. Many of us, we realize that the kind of empirical, objective world that we're used to, that we think is real, it kind of is real by mutual consent, but there's something bigger beyond that. And that's, of course, you know, dreams invite us into that. Spiritual exploration, like meditation, invites us to something beyond not only the mind, but beyond what the mind perceives. And equally, psychoactive substances invite us into that. So we all of us have so many portals into something deeper, which actually then gives life meaning and purpose.
So for this book, over the period of 15 years, you spoke to 420 extraordinarily intelligent executive leaders, entrepreneurs and people making a difference in the world, including Lynn Twist, Barnett Bain and Dr. Joe Vitale, to name just a few. Did you always have the intention to turn those interviews into a book, or did that idea come later?
Well, actually, you know, those interviews fueled many books. I started doing those interviews for The Translucent Revolution, which came out in 2005. So, you know, Radical Brilliance, the latest book, it's based upon all the interviews I've done over many, many years. And yeah, they've all been used in different ways. Some of them were broadcast, like you're interviewing me today. Some of those interviews went into other books, but altogether, it's actually by now, it's when I wrote the the thing you're reading from, it was 420. Now it's more like 470 because I keep doing more. You know, can't stop doing interviews. Probably like you. You and I, we've got the interview bug. So, mm-hmm. yeah, and you start to see patterns. And when you consistently interview people who are very, very brilliant and making a big difference, you start to notice patterns emerging. And it's in those patterns that we discover the key not only to brilliance and making a difference, but also to a life of fulfillment, to a life that's truly meaningful.
So you say that brilliance is innate. It's there inside of us. And if that's so, why aren't more of us aware of it?
Great. Well, the book describes a cycle, which maybe we can get into in a moment, the brilliance cycle. So the brilliance cycle, it explains how brilliance happens, but equally, it's a kind of a diagnostic tool for how brilliance doesn't happen. The brilliance cycle also explains the blockages that happen to natural brilliance. And natural brilliance is like, you know, when you and I went to school, to kindergarten years ago, no one had to teach us how to play, right? A small child instinctively knows how to play. And when a child plays, it's not going to be imitative. A child playing with crayons or whatever is going to do unusual things. And that's why often we like to watch children play, because that reminds us of that innocence, of that uncultured, unconditioned, just innocent playfulness. Same with animals. You know, animals don't operate from an operating manual. They're spontaneous. So we lose that through conditioning, through what we call the mind. And the brilliance cycle actually shows us where there is blockage in the cycle and how to unblock it through deliberate practice.
So do you think that most of these blockages are, familial, cultural conditioning?
Yeah, I would say so. A lot of them, yeah. Yes, exactly. I mean, it's easier to answer that question when we talk a little bit about the cycle, because the cycle involves four different quadrants, each of which has its birth in the fulfillment of the previous quadrant. So when you start to understand the different quadrants and how they play into each other, then blockage and how to unblock things becomes clearer, because it's actually different in each of the different quadrants.
So describe the brilliant cycle to us.
Sure. Well, you can think of it something like a clock, you know, with 12 at the top, 3 on the right, 6 at the bottom, 9 on the left. And so there are actually, just like a clock, you know, a clock that is not broken, that is working, it's never fixed at one particular point. A clock is constantly moving. The hour hand on the clock is constantly moving through the different points on the clock. I don't know how to say that, the minutes or something. So it's actually, it's not really exactly 12 o'clock. Ever, because it's the hand is moving through. You know, it's a little before 12, a little before 12, a little after 12, a little after 12, but it actually just moves through 12. It's like a second before, then it's a second after. So in the same way, this cycle is constantly in movement. So the first phase, we could say, is from 12 to 3, if you think of it on the clock. And that is the phase. So at 12 o'clock is what we call moments of awakening. Those are moments where you transcend the limits of the mind, and you experience limitless consciousness without any boundaries. So that we usually experience that through spiritual experience, sometimes through psychotropic substances, could be from extreme sports. There are various ways to experience consciousness without limits. So the first movement is from this awakening, from this limitless consciousness at 12, moving through to creative flow at 3. But the movement from 12 to 3 is a continuous increasing of the frequency of these original impulses. So right after 12, you might just have the very, very faintest whisper of a creative impulse. Maybe you're sitting quietly and you just have a very faintest, like a shadow in the corner of your awareness, just the tiniest impulse of a new creative idea. And it builds in intensity from 12 to 3 until at 3 o'clock it's a full crescendo, like it's a raging symphony of creative flow. And but to move from 12 to 3, from the spiny's impulses to creative flow, we need to understand how that quadrant works and what gets in the way of it. So we can come back and talk more about that. We can also talk about the brain chemistry involved, because each of these quadrants involves quite different brain chemistry. Now, when should I keep going? Do you want me to go?
Yeah, keep going.
Yeah. Okay. So that's the fullness of creative flow at 3. So in the fullness of creative flow, when everything is flowing completely, there is birthed another new impulse at 3, which starts with a tiny flicker, which is called intention. So intention is a creative act. When you have an intention for something, it is completely, it's part of creative flow. But intention is flow with a future attached to it. So it's flow attached to a future intended outcome. And so the movement from 3 to 6 is the movement from intention to actualization or accomplishment. At 6 o'clock, that's where things get done. That's where we finish the book, or we finish the CD, or we complete something. And it has a certain endorphin rush, as you probably know, when you get something done, when you get complete, it's like, I did it. You have a certain, there's a certain euphoric feeling in your brain. So the movement from 3 to 6 is the mechanics of accomplishment, which is really all of the literature about success and, you know, productivity all of that. I mean, the whole kind of, you know, making money, accomplishing things in the world, the whole understanding of that is from 3 to 6. So 6 o'clock, when you're at 6 o'clock, you've got something done. But there's a strange thing. I forget, Sandy, did you have children yourself?
Yes.
Yeah, so you might have had flickers of what they call postpartum depression. Did you ever experience that?
No, I didn't, but I know it's very real, and many people do.
Yeah, many people do. So postpartum depression is something you'd never anticipate, you know, that a woman has been pregnant for 9 months, she's been waiting and waiting to have a baby. It's like, you know, that's her joy, and now the baby's there, it's a cute baby, and she feels depressed. It's like, what? You know, you'd not something you would logically anticipate. But we can experience postpartum depression not only with childbirth, but we can also experience postpartum depression with creative projects too.
Yes.
You're building up to getting a project finished, and wow, we're going to do it, we're going to launch, we're going to get it out, and then it comes out, and there's a feeling of deflation. And mm-hmm. that is actually because of the relationship between the sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system. So when you're building up to get something done, as you get closer to 6 in this cycle, you get taken over by a kind of pressure to meet the deadline, which means that you suppress symptoms from your body of wanting a drink of water, wanting to go to the bathroom, needing to sleep, needing to eat, needing to stretch. All of those things get suppressed, because you're so intent on getting this project out the door. Now, once you actually get it complete, we see a phenomenon which is known as parasympathetic flooding, which means we don't simply go back to, we don't simply just gradually swing back to the parasympathetic nervous system. There's a sudden flooding into the parasympathetic nervous system. Suddenly you're overwhelmed, suddenly you feel really tired, or you feel really depressed, so all the emotions that you've pushed down now come to the surface. So this is what happens at 6 o'clock, is there's this flooding of everything you pushed away. And this is the next cycle from 6 to 9. It actually begins with feelings of regret, shame, remorse, insufficiency. It's where you feel not good enough. And maybe for good reason, because in the course of getting the thing done, you might have pushed down your own emotions, you might have been abrupt with somebody else, you might have been unkind. Lots of things happen to us when we're stressed. So right after 6 is where you feel flooded with kind of shame, like, oh, I can't believe I did that. And then this initiates the next movement from shame, remorse, regret, guilt, through learning, so you can integrate those feelings through learning, into at 9 o'clock humility, where you realize, yes, I'm limited, I'm frail, I'm weak, I don't know everything, but I'm doing my best. And that's self-acceptance. And that is actually characterized by GABA in the brain. That's the brain chemical GABA, which allows you to feel I've done my best and I deserve the right to rest. And finally, the last movement from 9 to 12, from humility back to awakening. When you're a 9 in humility, you realize I'm not really up to much. You know, I'm pretty limited. I'm a kind of very fallible human being. And so you start to have an intuition of something beyond your mind. Now, if that intuition points inwardly, you have an intuition of your true nature as limitless. So that's an intuition of, you could say, your higher self or your true nature. If that intuition points outwardly, then the intuition will become devotion and will focus on something like the divine, you know, or God, or whatever we want to call that. So either way, from 9 to 12, it's the movement from an intuition of something beyond the mind, merging with that and becoming that. And that brings us back into 12, into where we started with awakening, and the cycle continues. This cycle can happen during a day, it can happen during your week, it can happen during the whole year, and it can certainly happen during the life of a project.
Well, I would imagine that the hardest part of that is, you know, getting into the first quadrant of the cycle. But we'll come back to that after the break. You're listening to What Is Going On. I'm Sandy Sedgbeer, and I'm speaking with best-selling writer, public speaker, and executive coach Arjuna Arda about his latest book, Radical Brilliance: The Anatomy of How and Why People Have Original Life-Changing Ideas, which offers a practical model for the hidden components which together make up a brilliant life. We'll be back with more from Arjuna Arda after the break.
The future of internet radio is here. OM Times Radio, IOM FM.
Ascending Hearts is no ordinary dating site, but a spiritual dating site with a purpose, to link you with your soulmate. We engineer the serendipity so you can trust that you will attune with someone that has the same matching vibration as you. Ascending Hearts, the conscious dating site for the spiritually aware. Try Ascending Hearts for free, ascendinghearts.com.
More than 24 million Americans have an autoimmune disorder, and that number continues to grow. I'm Sharon Saylor, and I'm one of those 24 million. To put that number in perspective, cancer affects about 9 million and heart disease up to 22 million. That's why I've brought together top experts and those thriving regardless of their diagnosis to bring you the latest, most up-to-date information. Join me, Sharon Saylor, Friday night, 7 p.m. Eastern, for the Autoimmune Hour on Life Interrupted Radio to find out how to live your life uninterrupted.
Hi, this is New Age Grammy winner Paul Avgerinos. Thanks for listening to OM Times Radio, and please support my peaceful healing music with a purchase at iTunes, Amazon, or wherever you shop for fine music. Just put my name into the search engine, Paul Avgerinos, A, V like Victor, G like George, E-R-I-N-O-S. You can also visit me at roundskymusic.com. Thanks for listening, and I'm wishing you the brightest of blessings.
I'm Fidel Nshombo. I was born in a city called Bukavu in the Congo.
We were a loving family, and then, boom, everything that I had disappeared in a single day.
People think that when you are a refugee and they resettle you to America, and all your problems are done. They don't understand that that's the beginning of everything.
I was not born a refugee. I was made one.
It's time we welcome refugee families with open arms. Learn more at embracerefugees.org, brought to you by the Ad Council.
Welcome back. Arjuna Arda, as I mentioned before the break, the hardest part, obviously, is, you know, at number 12, moving to number 3. Now, the book covers a number of chapters in which you outline, you know, different ways that we can maximize our chances of being brilliant. You know, you have some wonderfully titled chapters. There's chapters on sleep, vacations, diet, routines, even brilliant sex, which, you know, we can talk about or not, depending on how you feel. There's an awful lot to get through. So why don't you tell us what you most want people to know that will help them begin to really come to, you know, get to grips with what you're offering them in Radical Brilliance?
Yeah, thanks, Sandy. excuse me, I just had to attend to my cat for a moment, so there's a tiny bit of background noise. Yeah, so I think, you know, the most important thing really, there is one really fundamental misunderstanding, which we all share, which is at the core of why people don't feel as great as they could, you know? And the core misunderstanding really is that we instinctively think that we're going to enjoy life through focusing on acquisition. How can I get more for me? How can I get more money for me or me and my and the people close to me? Now, how can I have a bigger house? How can I be more important? How can I be more visible? And so we think that we're going to have a great life by getting more for me and basically regarding the needs of other people or other sentient beings as less important. But actually, that doesn't really work. You know, whether we focus on getting money or trying to find your soulmate or, you know, trying to become famous or whatever, or trying to live forever and have perfect health, as long as we're focusing on me and my needs, it actually perpetuates a sort of not enough mentality. And on the other hand, not many people know this, but every now and then, somebody like Lynn Twist or, you know, John Gray, or we could give a host of people, fall into the recognition that when you fully dedicate yourself to serving other people and your motivation for every action and thought during the day is service to something beyond yourself, in a mysterious way, everything you thought you were going to get from focusing on your desires actually gets fulfilled in the background. And this is really the core of, you know, why I wrote this book. The book is about contribution. The book is not a book about self-improvement. It's not how to make more money. It's not how to have better sex. I mean, the chapter on sex is not about more pleasurable sex. It's about how sex can fuel brilliance, you know. So everything in the book is actually about how you can position yourself to be a conduit of brilliance, really dedicated to everybody, to humanity and all life, and not only today, but dedicated to the well-being of people who are not yet born. So that is really, if you ask me to kind of bring it down to one nutshell, as you did, then that would be the core of it, is to realize that a truly blessed, fulfilled life that overflows with gratitude and meaning and purpose and energy comes from putting contribution at the core.
Well, here's the paradox, isn't it? I mean, you're talking about Maslow's hierarchy of needs. When we reach that place of self-awareness and all our needs are taken care of, then we turn our thoughts outward to what can we do to enhance life for others. But there are so many books around that promise to make us smarter, happier, more successful. And I think you refer on your website to the ever-expanding field of genius enhancement even. At the same time, these books are feeding that sense of I'm not enough, I've got to do more, I've got to be successful, I've got to be smarter, happier, even more brilliant. So why is it that we alone, of all the species that inhabit this planet, have this preoccupation with improving ourselves?
Well, okay, that's a great question. Before we just get to your question, I want to just make us a little bit of a distinction there, because I think you put some things together that I'm not sure are exactly the same. So you could read a self-help book to become what you think is a better person. And that would certainly constitute what you described of, you know, feeling not enough and feeling that you have to do something to make yourself better. And the same would apply to, looking for things outside yourself, like looking for your soulmate, looking for money. These are all based on the feeling that I don't have enough or I'm not enough. But once you recognize the possibility of being in service to evolution, of being an instrument of evolution, then something else happens, which may look the same on the surface, but it's not quite the same, really. Something different happens, which is where we recognize that there is a crisis on this planet right now of many, many different varieties. I mean, there's a huge environmental crisis. There's a humanitarian crisis. There's a crisis of imbalance of income and resources. there's also a crisis of debt. You know, there are so many things about the world today that are completely out of balance. And actually, what is needed more than anything is people who are willing to dedicate their lives to improving the situation for everybody and everything alive, not just to their own needs. So although I appreciate that a book about genius, I suppose, could look like another self-improvement book, there is a distinction between trying to make yourself better because you feel inadequate and realizing that there is a job to be done and wanting to be of service and then looking for ways to be of service. So let me give you an example. An example, I can't remember if it was in the book or if it was in a blog post, but I'll give you a good example. Imagine there's a fire, right? Imagine there's a big fire, a building's on fire, and upstairs on the fourth floor, there's a woman and her child. So the fire engine goes rushing through the night, you know, going through the red light. Now, why would the fire people, firemen, firewomen, why would they be willing to risk their lives by running through a red light? Because they're in service. They're not doing it for their own gratification. They're not doing it to get money or fame. They're rushing through the night, risking their lives because they want to be of service to other people. So finally, the fire engine arrives. You know, it arrives at the place. They start to put the ladder up, and now the fireman is putting on his I'm going to make this a guy. It doesn't matter. But putting on his gear to go rescue the child. You know, at that moment, he's not going to stop and say, "Wait a minute. You know, do I need to open my heart more?" He's not going to stop and thought. He's not going to stop at that moment and go on Tinder to look for a soulmate. You know, or some other site. He's not going to. There's lots of things he's not going to do because he's going to be completely, totally focused on saving that life. And when he climbs the ladder to save his life, he's putting his own life at risk. But there is really relatively little self-interest involved in it. He's fully dedicated to making a difference to somebody else. And if he rescues that child and the mother and comes back down the ladder, he's going to feel amazing, but not because he got something from me, not because he was focused on how can I fulfill my needs. He's going to feel amazing because he lived from the best version of himself. Now, in order to live your whole life like that, it does require some modification, all right? In order to live your life like that, it does require seeing the places in your life that are contracted into self-interest and letting them go so they can flow more. So you could think of that because it is also a book, right? And because it is also about making modifications, you could think of that as another form of self-improvement, but it's not. It's getting over the narcissism of self-improvement so you can actually live a life of real meaning. So that's just the first thing I wanted just to point out, that putting, we want to be careful not to lump these things together, because making tweaks in your life so you can have more pleasure is very different than making tweaks in your life so that you can actually open up to service more. So a good example would be meditation. You know, meditation, or I don't actually like to call it that because it becomes a kind of a thing you do, but sitting quietly in the morning or doing qigong or something is a way of bringing your mind and nervous system into the best possible state to be of service. And people who are brilliant, people who make a big difference to the world, they do often have practices like that. Or they might use a nootropic enhancement like Qualia to put their mind to the best possible state. But it's not fueled by a feeling of I'm not enough, I want to become a better person. It's doing whatever you need to do to put your nervous system into the best possible condition to be of service. So now, having said that, let me come directly to your question, because you were asking really about the first category, not so much about leading a life of service. You were asking about self-improvement, and why do we have self-improvement? Why do we have this self-improvement industry, which is for the most part very narcissistic and self-absorbed? Why do we have that when so many other creatures don't? For example, I mentioned in the book that, you know, penguins don't suddenly ponder how can I be a better penguin. You know, you don't catch your dog on the back porch kind of dreaming of how can I merge with a big dog in the sky. So as far as we know, we are the only creature that has this kind of self-obsession with wanting to change itself or improve itself or feel there's something wrong. So the answer is, you know, I think the reason is because of our highly developed prefrontal cortex. And the prefrontal cortex is actually, it's really what's responsible for cognitive thinking. It's what allows you to evaluate, to be able to look at your life and say, oh, well, this could be better, this, you know, this is great, this could be better. So it's what allows evaluation, but it's also what allows you to imagine another state different than the one you're in. So the prefrontal cortex also allows you to think of something else, a potential something else in the future, and to aspire towards it. So that's, as far as we know, animals with less developed prefrontal cortex don't have that ability. They live more in the moment, you know? So in a funny way, actually, the activity in the prefrontal cortex is actually sort of the opposite of being present or being in a meditative state. Although it's very useful to be able to make cognitive assessment, it can easily become an addiction. So because of this prefrontal cortex, instead of simply experiencing things as they are, we have the ability to evaluate things and to imagine how they could be better. And that gap between how things are and how they could be better is a great blessing if it's used judiciously, but it can become just a nightmare if it takes over your whole life.
I don't disagree with anything.
Does that address that?
It does, and I don't disagree with anything that you've said. The point I wanted to make is that certainly we know there are so many people who have been successful who then get the whole point of it all is that, you know, it's not the success itself that brings them the satisfaction. It's being able to do something for others. All the research shows that giving is better than receiving. You know, people who live a life of service are happier, healthier, live longer, etc., etc. That's not in doubt. The issue is getting to that point when people are bombarded, you know, by you've got to be more successful, you've got to be wealthier, you've got to do these things, you've got to improve yourself, and they don't know where to start, because none of the books really do it, to be honest. You know, they all offer lots of their own prescriptions, but how many of them are actually successful as that? How do you get people from that place? People who have very real, you know, needs, they have families to feed, they need to earn more, they, you know, need to get a better house maybe because the other one's leaking or whatever. How do you get people like that to a place where they are ready to hear what you have to say, that they can actually have all that by doing things differently?
Well, Sandy, you know, in my own small and modest way, that was the purpose of Radical Brilliance. You know, the book is actually written exactly to address what you said. It's not a self-improvement book. It's a book that will kindle and encourage this little inkling we have of a life of real meaning and purpose. And, you know, I was able to write it by interviewing so many people whose lives are just absolutely overflowing with depth and purpose and energy. And then, the answer to your question, you know, what can we do? I think that's actually the whole point, is that it's not one thing, you see. It's brilliance, or a life of brilliance and meaning and purpose and energy and depth and connection. That kind of a life is not really the result of one thing. You know, that's maybe the trap of the kind of self-help industry, is that it narrows things down too much. Brilliance actually is the result of completely contrary things balancing each other out. In the same way, if we were to talk about health, you know, we could say, well, what do you need to do to be healthy? And somebody might say, well, you need regular bowel movements. If you have regular bowel movements, you're going to be healthy. But that's not the only truth. You also need to eat well. You need to put food in one end and take it out the other, you know. So that's a balance of opposites. Equally, you could say, well, what do you need to be healthy? You need to get enough sleep. You need to get a good night's sleep every night. So then you could say, great, well, if I just stay in bed 24/7, then I'll be healthy. No, you need to balance that good night's sleep with exercise, and those two are opposites. And we could keep going, you know, that if we wanted to talk about physical health, almost any element we could suggest, the opposite would also be needed. And in the same way, a life of brilliance, actually, this is why, you know, you were asking, why do so many of these books kind of not work? Because what we tend to want to do is to focus on one thing and say, this is the key. But it may well be that this is the key combined with its opposite, right? And that's what the brilliant cycle demonstrates, is this coexistence of opposites, of awakening to your true nature where there really is no localized self, and being fully responsible. Those are opposites. Those are opposite contradictory values. They're philosophically, they contradict each other. but they need to both be there for your life to be brilliant. Equally, what happens at 3 o'clock, we were talking about earlier, where you're full of creative flow, like anything seems possible. Wow, we can shoot for the moon. We can do anything we want. That has to be balanced with the humility of 9 o'clock. You see, now humility and no limits, they don't really go together. Humility is all about limits. You know, well, I'm kind of small. I don't really know everything. You know, I'm doing my best. So this is the thing, is actually the brilliant cycle is not really offering you one key. It's giving you the understanding that brilliance is the natural result of these different components in balance with each other.
So what you're offering is a prescription to help people bring all these components together.
Yeah, and initially to recognize what the components are, and to recognize I did my research. If you look at the lives of people who are focused on contribution, even though by being focused on contribution, money flows easily, relationships are loving and playful, they've got plenty of energy. People like that usually live much longer than the average person in good health. You know, like Lynn Twist, she's in her mid-70s, still traveling all the time. Barbara Marx Hubbard, almost 90, you know, constantly teaching. So people like this who are really dedicated to contribution, they get everything that we tried to get through acquisition, but it comes as a byproduct of something else.
Well, after the break, what we'll do is we'll take a little look at some of these components. You're listening to What Is Going On. I'm Sandy Sedgbeer, and my guest is best-selling writer, public speaker, and executive coach Arjuna Arda, whose latest book, Radical Brilliance, shares the wisdom and secrets of over 420 brilliantly intelligent leaders, entrepreneurs, and thinkers. We'll be back with more on these topics after the break.
The cutting edge of conscious radio, OM Times Radio, IOM FM. Being a radio host on IOM FM allows you to build your show on a rich platform with the power of the internet to fulfill your outreach goals and connect with a very specialized and global online audience, unlimited by time and distance. OM Times Radio will provide you with web relevance, a recognizable conscious brand, and with the standard of excellence that has accompanied every single OM Times endeavor. Host your show with OM Times Radio Network.
My name is Victor Furman. Some call me The Voice. I've always been fascinated with human nature, spirituality, science, and the crossroads at which they meet. Join me Wednesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern on OM Times Radio, and we'll explore these topics and so much more on Destination Unlimited.
Hi, this is recording artist and composer Yuval Ron, inviting you to a voyage through the chakras, a new double album of guided meditations to transform your life, a sublime musical medicine for nourishing inner peace and reaching to your higher virtues. Get it now at metamindfulnessmusic.com, M-E-T-T-A, mindfulnessmusic.com.
Imagine being fired because of who you love. Imagine being denied medical treatment because of who you marry. Imagine being evicted because of who you are. Millions of Americans don't have to imagine this. They have to live it. Because in 31 states, it's legal to discriminate against LGBT people. Get the facts at beyondido.org. Brought to you by the Gill Foundation and the Ad Council.
Welcome back. Arjuna Arda, in the book you cover many, many different areas, and it's impossible for us to mention them all here. But one of the things that you talk about is creating an ideal daily routine to maximize our chances. Could you briefly tell us a little bit about that? And then I want to talk about one of the chapters that particularly fascinated me.
Great. Well, a couple of quick footnotes. First of all, if we have a chance, I'd love to make a comment on what you said about the hierarchy of needs of Maslow, because actually Lynn Twist kind of debunked a lot of Maslow's theory, so it'd be interesting to maybe comment on that. And also, you did also mention chats on brilliant sex, and the answer is I'm totally happy to talk about brilliant sex if you'd like to. Quick couple of footnotes.
I don't know that we're going to have time to go into all of that. I'm certainly open to discussion about debunking the hierarchy of needs. But tell us a little bit first about the brilliant routine, because that is, you know, a foundation part of this.
Sure. Absolutely. Well, the brilliant routine was really, you know, compiling all of the research that I did on all these different people and how they live. And so you can see common elements. For example, almost everybody I interviewed who leads an extraordinary life disrupts the normal sleep patterns. But the most common way is to be getting up very early in the morning. So I would say the majority of people I interviewed wake up unusually early. Like I wake up at 4:30 in the morning, which is at this time of year, you know, a good 2 hours before the sun comes up. So this is one thing, that there's something very special about the time before the dawn, so that you set up your life to be fully awake, fully present as the sun rises. Other of the elements in brilliant routine are adjusting your diet to that cycle. So that means doing the majority of your eating in the morning, at breakfast and lunch, and eating very lightly in the evening. As well as that, you know, the brilliant routine allows you to move through all phases of the cycle in the day. So at night, you've been asleep, so you've actually been in a kind of 12 o'clock state, although it was unconscious. So when you first wake up in the morning, ideally very early in the morning, you spend an hour or so, or maybe not that long, but you spend 40 minutes or more going back into that empty state. So that's the 12 o'clock. So, and that's, you know, in the book we call that sitting, and there's quite a lot of information about how to sit in an effective way. And that can overflow into some kind of movement. It could be dance or qigong. But it leads you into the 12 to 3. The 12 to 3, which we talked about earlier in our conversation today, is where creative impulses increase in their frequency and magnitude and become expressed. And that's really, that can best be done around the dawn. If you're fully awake, fully prepared, your body is exercised, your mind is clear, if you can be available around the time of the dawn, that's when it's most likely that understanding and notions will come into your awareness that are often just blocked out by the sort of chaos of internal and external activity that happens during the day. So most of the day, of course, because of the society we live in, is lived in the what we call the 3 to 6 phase. So most of the day, from when you first switch on your computer to when you switch it off at the end of the day, is going to be spent answering emails and meeting deadlines, and that's all the things we talked about as 3 to 6. But another thing about the brilliant routine is at the end of the day to have a time when you deliberately allow yourself to move into learning. So I usually recommend people do that, you know, when you've finished working, when you close the laptop or leave the office or whatever, to have some time and you can really reflect upon your mistakes and things you regret and things that are weighing heavy on your heart, so that you can actually learn from them and integrate them. Having that time of learning, it's not only that you do things better, but it's also that you return back into humility and realize that you are, as a localized entity, you are dependent upon an intelligence bigger than your own mind. And then the 9 to 12, well, that, you know, that happens, that can happen before you go to sleep. It happens kind of during the night as well, but particularly it happens in the morning when you wake up. 9 to 12, you know, one way of being in 9 to 12 is prayer, you know, is shifting your attention from me and my needs and my understanding to something so much bigger. And that's a good thing to do at night before you go to sleep.
You talk about four kinds of blockages in the book. Mm. And in my experience, one of the biggest things that gets in people's way, prevents them from moving forward in their life, is usually their own you know, thoughts about their worthiness or their capabilities. In chapter 16, Brilliance Beyond Belief, that chapter is based on the story of Robert Richman, who invented the X pill, a placebo, which allows people to become aware of hidden sabotaging thoughts. Say a few words about that.
Yeah, well, the X pill is an example of how, as soon as we're willing to question our mind or to question the limitations that our mind imposes, new things become possible. So Robbie Richman, he developed this pill. He actually gave it out first to people at Burning Man, and he realized that people could really transcend self-imposed limitations as soon as they were given an excuse to. So he gave them this pill. It was colored red, and they just swallow the pill, and suddenly they find the things they thought they couldn't do, they can do, because it was all just imposed by mind. So that's definitely an important part of freeing up the brilliant cycle. And that's how the 12 to 3 phase moves more smoothly, is when we are willing to listen less to what our mind thinks is true.
So what sort of response have you had to the book and to the practices that you share in the book?
Well, amazing, actually, Sandy, because the Radical Brilliance is now a company called the Radical Brilliance Project. So we have, at this point, we have 8 trained coaches. We're about to train 20 more. And so we are able to work with really innovative leaders. Our company works with CEOs, with people writing books, with entrepreneurs, with people who really want to make a difference. And yeah, it's unbelievable how much people can get freed up in their brilliance and become just incredibly much more effective at what they're wanting to do. So the response has been fantastic. This is not really a kind of, this is not exactly, this is a book designed for a very specific audience. You know, the book is designed for people who really want to use their lives to change the course of humanity. And what's been wonderful is it is reaching those people. You know, we've been able to reach leaders in Silicon Valley. We've been able to reach leaders in technology, particularly in kind of environmental technology, people who are creating technology to heal the environment, to restore damage that's been done. So the book has been incredibly effective at reaching the people who can make good use of it.
Of all the 460 some people that you've spoken to over the last goodness knows how many years, who among those impressed you the most and why?
Okay, that's a great question. Well, I would have to say Daniel Schmachtenberger, who maybe you've heard of, maybe you haven't. He developed the nootropic called Qualia, but that's really just a kind of hobby for him. So he developed this capsule called Qualia, which actually gives you greater mental clarity. It's a nootropic designed to increase brilliance. But he is just generally the most extraordinarily brilliant mind I've ever spoken to. He thinks of everything in a disruptive way. You know, there's this sort of mantra of disruptive thinking, which is who says? You know, this is the mantra of thinking different, is who says it has to be that way? Who made the rules here? So Daniel is really a master of thinking of things in a completely different way, thinking outside the box. Equally, Miki Agarwal is really like that too. She wrote a book called Disruptor. Lynn Twist, Alex Ebert, the founder of Edward Sharpe and Magnetic Zeros. There's a lot of people who really just continuously surprise you with their ability to think differently.
So along the way, as you speak to these people, you must have been aware that you were changing too in response to the knowledge, the information you were receiving. What do you think was the biggest change that you've made?
Well, I think really what's happened for me over the last few years since starting to focus on this project is it's really just the recognition has gone much deeper in me that trying to live life for yourself or for your own desires is really a dead end and leads to frustration and a constant feeling of not enough. But actually constantly looking for ways to uplift, to support, to move everything in an evolutionary direction. If you just wake up in the morning and just look for every opportunity to do that during the day, you get the reward of this incredible satisfaction and peace, and everything falls into place. You know, it's extraordinary how many synchronicities happen. It's like you're surrounded by angels, you know, invisible angels who are just carrying you forward through the day. So I think that's really what has happened for me, is it's talking to so many people in this way has absolutely dissolved any doubt in me that contribution is the key to a good life.
Well, that kind of brings us back to Lynn Twist and her debunking of Maslow's hierarchy of needs. So tell us what Lynn says about that.
Yeah, well, you know, she did it very kindly and humorously. Of course, she respects Maslow as a great innovator, but Abraham Maslow, he created this theory called the hierarchy of needs, where he said, basically, you need to first take care of your food and shelter, and then you can take care of immediate relationships, and then you can take care of, you know, money and so on. And then at the peak is what he calls self-actualization. And in his opinion, it's only in self-actualization that you really get to kind of make a contribution. And Lynn Twist said that's just not been her experience. You know, she actually talked to me in the interview I did with her in the book, you know, that she's been to worn, torn areas where people really don't have their next meal. And she's met people, you know, in Ethiopia, in Bosnia, who were absolutely willing to put their own lives aside to help other people. So she actually, Lynn said, you know, you have the opportunity to dedicate your life to service and the well-being of others under any circumstances. You don't have to have all of your material needs met in order to live a life of service, or in order, in fact, to experience what Maslow called self-actualization. So, you know, and I'm not saying anyone is completely right or wrong. You can make arguments either way. But I think Lynn's point is just it's good to put Maslow in perspective and realize it's one way of seeing things, but it's not the Bible. Because the problem with the hierarchy of needs that Maslow postulated, I think it was in the 50s, is it can become an excuse for people to postpone. And in fact, during the 70s and the kind of, you know, the time when the human potential movement was born, a lot of people felt they had to work on themselves in all these ways and really make themselves better and better and better. So later, they could do something useful with their lives. And actually, Lynn's saying it's not true. You can do something wildly generous and contributing right now in the very condition you're in this moment.
I agree with her, and I do think that Maslow's work, I mean, as you said, you know, it came out in the 50s, a time in, you know, just after two world wars that he'd probably lived through. So he was looking at it through a different lens, and that may have been his observations and experiences. I think it's true that we do have these impulses. We do, at the basis of ourselves, you know, want to be giving and kind. And I think that conditioning is what twists a lot of our natural impulses along the way. And much of that, I think, is media. You know, it comes from outside of us, not inside of us.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, and that's really why I wrote this book, because so much of the media is running, and advertising in particular, is working on desire and fear. Both politicians and big companies are either saying, you've got to have this new thing in order to be happy. But in order to get this new thing or subscribe to this new thing, you have to get more and more plugged into working to make money to pay for all this stuff that you think is going to make you happy. And equally, there's fear. You know, I mean, our present political climate in America is thriving on massive amounts of fear and just playing into the insecurities that people have anyway, but then amplifying them to a panic where you lose all sight of what's really good and true. And living your life out of compulsive desire or fear is going to lead to a very frenetic, unhappy life. But if you can find ways to contribute, whether it's contributing beauty or love or innovation or new understanding, if you can find a way to contribute so that it's for the good of everybody, it's going to lead to a different kind of fulfillment. It's not the same kind of fulfillment as the rush of fulfilling a desire. But think about it like Christmas, you know. I mean, most of us have celebrations at Christmas, you know, and there's one pleasure you get as a child, you know, from getting a new shiny object. You rip open the paper and you get this shiny object and like, wow, you know. But of course, we all know that that wears off. You know, that new shiny object is maybe doesn't look so shiny or amazing a couple of days later. But then think of the different pleasure you get at Christmas if you're an adult, especially if you have children, the pleasure you get from giving those gifts, you know, and seeing the happiness on the face of a child when that child unwraps the gift you gave. Or think about when you create a beautiful meal at Christmas and people enjoy it. That's a different kind of fulfillment. That's a satisfaction that connects you to your own internal goodness. And that's a satisfaction that leads to peace and leads to more fulfillment. Whereas the craving for a new experience to temporarily alleviate my itch of craving just leads to more itching, you know? So it's a fundamental shift in our understanding of what creates a good life.
Absolutely. Arjuna, we're almost out of time now. Would you like to briefly, before we close, just tell our listeners about what's on offer at the website radicalbrilliance.com?
Yeah, great. Well, if you go to radicalbrilliance.com, if you just scroll down on the first page, you'll see there's a video there where I welcome you. And then if you put in your name and email, we'll send you a whole bunch of cool stuff. We'll send you an ebook that goes through the whole cycle and the blockages and practices. And then over 5 days, we'll send you a series of videos that explains all of this.
Arjuna Adar, thank you very much.
Thank you, Sandy. Thank you.
Bye-bye. So to purchase a copy of Arjuna Adar's new book, you can get it on Amazon. You can also get it at radicalbrilliance.com, along with all of those gifts that Arjuna has just mentioned. I'm Sandy Sedgbeer. Thanks for joining me today, and I look forward to being with you at the same time next week. Till then, it's goodbye from me.